I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area. Tonight, both San Francisco and Oakland will likely have to close public schools in the coming years. San Francisco Chronicle education reporter Jill Tucker tells us why that is and what it will mean for local families. And we'll delve into a realm of scientific inquiry that affects us all, aging. Get ready to call in with your questions about how to keep your brain and body healthy in later life. Plus, we'll visit the world's largest collection of Star Wars memorabilia. It's at the museum Rancho Obi-Wan. But first, this news.
I'm Jack Spear. The U.S. Supreme Court has once again put a controversial Texas border enforcement law on hold. As the Texas Newsroom's Julian Aguilar reports, SB 4 would allow local and state law enforcement to arrest people suspected of illegally crossing into Texas from Mexico.
The high court's order keeps the law on hold indefinitely as the case plays out in the federal court system. A federal judge blocked the law from going into effect last month, but the state of Texas appealed that decision to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Opponents say the law is unconstitutional because the federal government has the sole authority to enforce immigration laws. But Texas Republicans, including Governor Greg Abbott, say the law is necessary, blaming the Biden administration for an increase in illegal immigration. Opponents also argue that the law could lead to racial profiling and that people of color anywhere in Texas could be subject to racial profiling if SB 4 is allowed to stand. I'm Julian Aguilar in El Paso.
Florida is pushing back against a newly proposed federal rule that would promote diversity, equity, and inclusion practices in apprenticeship programs throughout the nation. Danielle Pryor with member station WMFE in Orlando has more.
Florida passed the Stop Woke Act in 2022, attempting to block DEI instruction in businesses and schools. Although a federal judge blocked much of that law earlier this month, then last year, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed additional legislation stopping public universities and colleges from funding DEI programs. Now, Florida's Attorney General and the state's Commerce and Education Departments have rejected a proposed federal rule that would require apprenticeship programs to incorporate aspects of DEI. Florida Commissioner of Education Manny Diaz wrote that the rule would, quote, deprive students of opportunities and damage businesses. States have until the end of today to comment on the rule. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Pryor in Orlando.
The Biden administration is banning the use of asbestos, a substance known to cause cancer. NPR's Michael Copley reports the EPA says asbestos is linked to more than 40,000 deaths in the U.S. each year.
The Environmental Protection Agency says companies can no longer use asbestos to make things like brake pads and chlorine for disinfecting water. The ban is part of the Biden administration's Cancer Moonshot, which aims to cut the death rate from the disease by at least half by 2047. Exposure to asbestos is known to cause lung cancer, mesothelioma, and ovarian cancer. The use of asbestos has been declining for years, but the EPA says one type of the substance was still being imported as recently as 2022. Asbestos is already banned in more than 50 countries, and the U.S. has had a partial ban on some products that contain asbestos for decades. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Stocks closed mostly higher today to start the new trading week. The Dow gained 75 points. The Nasdaq was up 130 points. You're listening to NPR.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Do you want to live forever? Tonight we'll be talking to Dr. Eric Verdun about how you might do just that. He heads the Buck Institute, which is working to tackle age-related diseases and researching how we can live longer, healthier lives. And later, we're calling all you space nerds. We're talking about the world's largest collection of Star Wars memorabilia. Maybe you thought that it was in your house, but it's actually at Rancho Obi-Wan. So stay tuned for that. But first, budget cuts in the San Francisco and Oakland school districts may lead to more school closures. Earlier this month, San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Matt Wayne outlined his plan for school closures. And not long after that, Oakland School President and Superintendent acknowledged that school closures or mergers were likely inevitable for their district as well. Here to help us unpack all this news, I'm pleased to welcome back Jill Tucker, education reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Glad to have you back, Jill.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah. Well, let's start with San Francisco. Tell us how SFUSD's Superintendent Matt Wayne broke the news about school closures and how it was received.
Yeah, so he basically announced it as part of an annual summit of parents and teachers and school leaders, where they discuss the budget as they plan for the upcoming year, how they're going to spend the money that they have, some options for, and he basically just said, we're going to be starting a process to take a look at how we reorganize, how we reevaluate our portfolio of schools. And ultimately, he said, given the declining enrollment, the loss of ultimately 10,000 students, we need to look at our portfolio. He was very careful with his wording, and we need to have fewer schools. When I spoke to him prior to the summit and he talked about this, he didn't want to use the word closure. He really wanted to just talk about the reorganization and coming up with a new portfolio of schools that had fewer schools. So that could mean consolidations and mergers and closures. But ultimately, what he acknowledged is, given the population of students, there are too many schools. And that means resources are spread too thin. So, you know, obviously, no one likes closing schools. It is arguably the most emotional topic in education. And having gone through covering this over a couple decades now, it is my least favorite topic to cover. It is gut-wrenching. You know, this is where people make friends. You know, this is where kids make friends, where parents make friends. It is the core of a community. And it's incredibly emotional, and the people making the decisions are having to do so, you know, looking at rational numbers and other things. So, it was not well received.
Yeah, I can imagine. Are they looking at closures all the way through K through 12, or is it particularly targeting elementary schools, junior highs? Do we know?
We don't know. And so really what he announced is that the district is just at the beginning of what will be a months-long process. The first step is creating a task force, really, to determine how the district will decide which schools to consider for mergers or how they will, you know, this new portfolio. And they will do an equity audit. And once they come up with sort of this formula, they will then go through the process of applying that formula. And then ultimately, by around the beginning of September, we'll come up with a list and a number of schools. And so at this point, we have no idea how many. We have no idea what grade levels. We have no idea where in the city. There are no names. There are no schools on any lists. He really stressed that this is an open process, that there are no preconceived ideas. And, you know, come September, we will have a list, and then it will be, you know, this entire process will be with community input, and then the list will go through more community input, and then it will go for a vote before the school board by December. It's a long process.
It all kind of merges with this idea of these urban areas being in a doom loop. And I think we have had conversations on this show and even with you about where the kids have gone. And I'm curious, does this Unified School District have a sense of that? Are these kids enrolling in private schools, charter schools, parochial schools, or homeschooling, or have they just left the city?
You know, it's a combination of all those things, but we also need to remember that, you know, declining enrollment is an issue that is happening all across California and across the country and, frankly, around the world. There is a lower birth rate. There is a lot going on that is reflecting just a declining enrollment across everywhere. So charter schools are seeing it. Private schools are seeing it. This lower birth rate is just part of reality. However, there are some districts that are getting hit harder than others for a variety of reasons. So the cost of living in San Francisco obviously has always been an issue. Private schools have always been, since the beginning of time in San Francisco, been just a fact of life. A third of students typically, historically, have gone to private schools in San Francisco. That's not new. But it's a big chunk of the kids in San Francisco. So it's all of those things. But the loss of kids is not just in San Francisco. It is systemic. But the pandemic certainly didn't help San Francisco's cause, when they didn't reopen, like many other places. And so there's a lot going on, but ultimately they're looking at a loss of 10,000 students. And that means there are a lot of schools in San Francisco that are not even close to full.
Wow. And the declining enrollment also creates a budget problem for the school district and these schools. Tell us how that works.
Yeah. So schools are funded based on the number of students that show up every day. And so obviously enrollment impacts how many kids are showing up. And so so that means if there are fewer kids, there is less state funding. But the reality is when the kids are kind of the declining enrollment is spread across the entire district. So let's say you're losing a few kids out of every classroom. Well, you're not paying less in teachers or lights, electricity, custodians, all of these types of things, you know, fixing roofs, all of those things, all of the costs remain the same. So really you're getting less money in general in state revenue, but you have the same types of costs. And so the district hasn't really right-sized, if you will, in terms of staffing, in terms of programming. So they're basically, they have a lot fewer kids, but they haven't really reduced the staffing and the support and a lot of other things. So they're working on that right now as well, trying to consolidate students into classrooms so that they're, you know, that you don't have two classrooms of 15, you have one classroom of 30. So that and getting rid of vacancies so that they get vacant positions, so that they are eliminating those positions and those jobs and trying to, reduce their expenditures, because frankly, they are at the point of a fiscal cliff where if they do not reduce expenditures, they will get taken over by the state. That was made very clear at a recent board meeting, that they need to have an immediate hiring freeze. They need, it's very dire.
Wow.
So it is, yeah, it's not good. Closing schools don't often save a ton of money per se, but ultimately it means that you are not spreading your resources so thin. And that's, really what I think the district is looking at.
Well, across the Bay, we mentioned that Oakland is also thinking about closing schools. I mean, back in 2022, when they suggested doing that, I mean, that resulted in a hunger strike, even with two educators going on strike there. What's the story right now with Oakland?
Yeah, as you can imagine, it's, after there was a lot of drama and trauma related to the attempt to close schools. It's interesting because, there were school board members that, vehemently fought the school closures, including former board president Mike Hutchinson. And I think, once he became a school board member, he's realized the budget situation and the many, they have more than twice as many schools as similarly sized districts, and realizing like what that means for schools that have literally 100 kids. How do you maintain an elementary school when there are only 100 kids there? I mean, how do you do after school programs? How do you do our programs? How do you provide services how do you have a PTA? Mm-hmm. So they are really, I think they're realizing you can't sustain that. And so, even he's sort of come around with this idea that they need to figure this out. So they are embarking on the process again. They're going to have a vote at the end of the month. There is a state law that applies to Oakland and one other district where they have to do this equity audit. They can't disproportionately affect any group of students in closure. So it makes it really tough to try to do this. But I think they've realized that the superintendent is adamant that they have to do this. State officials, fiscal experts have all said they have to do this. It is not, it really isn't an option at this point, given the number of schools, the number of students in some of the schools, the number of students that the district has, the continued declining enrollment. So they'll take a vote at the end of the month to whether to embark on the process again. It will be a much longer process than the last time, including an equity audit, a lot of the similar things that San Francisco is doing. As the current school board president, Sam Davis, told me, misery loves company. I think we kind of like the idea that San Francisco is there with them this time around. But we'll see. They haven't officially started that process, but the superintendent has been adamant that it is a must do. And that they have to get the buy-in of the community and they have to go through this process.
Well, I mean, the superintendent said they have 11,000 empty seats. And I mean, that just seems more than just people not being around. I mean, is there a truancy issue as well happening?
Yes, that's separate from the 11,000 empty seats.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, the 11,000 are just the declining enrollment. And then on top of that, you have ongoing issues with chronic absenteeism, you know, related to the pandemic as well as prior to that. So it's, you know, they're battling a lot of those things like many districts. But they have had sort of the under-enrollment, under-enrolled schools for a long time and have really had difficulty in trying to fill their schools and trying to close schools. They really had a significant impact from the charter school movement. Unlike many other districts, there was just a welcome sign during the state takeover and during the Jerry Brown mayoral term. And so Oakland had disproportionately far more charter schools than many other communities. And so there's a lasting impact in terms of the enrollment in the district. So they've just, with the state takeover that they had, they just historically have had a lot of struggles fiscally, enrollment, a lot of political, you know, drama. It looks like now there's sort of politically aligned with the superintendent to make this happen. But we'll see.
Well, before we let you go, I just had to ask one more question, and that's about Proposition G, which is San Francisco voters passed, which was to bring algebra back to middle school, and that passed overwhelmingly. I mean, the city is committed to its students, so it's almost sad to hear about these closures. But I wanted to ask, what do you think that proposition's effect is going to be on schools?
You know, there's long been a lot of support for this. I think even the school district realized that this was something that needed to be done, and they're already, to a certain degree, by the time the election happened, it was moot because they're already bringing algebra back into the middle schools. I do think that it is going to bring some families back, or at least keep them, because that was an issue for some parents. It's hard to quantify how many parents might have left because of that issue or were considering leaving because of it over the years. But it obviously is something that is overwhelmingly supported. So that's a little bit of a positive for the district to sort of go with the popular vote in that. And, you know, so I think that's a win for the district in terms of popular support.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Jill Tucker is the K-12 education reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Listeners out there, follow her reporting. She's always got her thumb on the pulse of what's happening in the education system. Thanks again for joining us, Jill.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. And coming up next, we're going to hear about the world's largest Star Wars memorabilia collection at Rancho Obi-Wan. You might think you have a lot of Star Wars stuff, but wait till you hear about this place. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Peter Thompson from Bluegrass Signal, reminding you that supporting KALW is easy and extra beneficial when you become a sustaining member. This happens when you designate a monthly contribution that's charged to your preferred credit or debit card. All you need to do is click Make This a Monthly Donation on the Donate page at KALW.org, or tell the kind soul who answers your call at 800-400-4400. 525-9917. As a KALW sustaining member, you increase the value of your gift to us because you provide the station with a stable source of monthly income to support the programs you enjoy, you reduce the cost of processing your contribution, and you eliminate the cost and the hassle of membership renewal. A sustaining membership enables us to keep on-air fundraising to a minimum. Just decide how much you're able to donate to KALW each month. Click on Donate at KALW.org or call 800-525-9917 and deepen your engagement with local public radio with a sustaining membership.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, a brave alliance of underground freedom fighters challenged the tyranny and oppression of the evil Galactic Empire. Not so long ago, as in 1977, a young man, Steve Sansweet, started his collection of Star Wars figures and memorabilia. It is now the largest Star Wars memorabilia collection in the world, according to Guinness World Records, and is housed in a 9,000-square-foot structure right here in our own galaxy. Here to tell us about this new superstation, appropriately named Rancho Obi-Wan, is the collector himself, Steve Sansweet. Steve, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you, Fred. I feel like I've gone on a trip outside the galaxy and come back.
That's usually what happens when people talk with me. I'm totally kidding. Anyway, so I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I actually saw the original May 25th, 1977 when it premiered, so I'm one of those people. So tell us, what led you to the Star Wars collection memorabilia idea?
I grew up with the space age and loving science fiction, reading science fiction novels. Mm-hmm. And I started collecting Japanese robots and space toys. And then Star Wars came out and changed my life. I saw it on the back lot of 20th Century Fox 10 days before it opened. They had a media screening. I was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Los Angeles. And as I said, my life changed.
Wow. So you got to see it before May 25th.
Yes.
That's impressive. So how did Rancho Obi-Wan come about?
Well, I started collecting Star Wars items in addition to the space toys that I had. And I added a floor onto my house in Los Angeles for the collection. I added one floor on, then one floor became two floors. One storage locker became five storage lockers. And then I left the Wall Street Journal after 9 years as bureau chief in L.A. and joined Lucasfilm up in the Bay Area. And so I looked for a house with storage, and I found this place with former chicken barns that housed 20,000 hens up until the early 70s, according to my neighbors.
Wow.
And turned it into a warehouse initially. And when I knew I was leaving Lucasfilm and retiring in 2011, in 2010, we decided to turn it into a nonprofit museum and expand it.
Wow. So you started collecting in 1977. What was the first piece you got?
The first piece I got actually came to another reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and it was a marketing brochure from Lucasfilm and 20th Century Fox. He looked through it, beautiful brochure, threw it in his wastebasket. I waited till he left for the day, traipsed over to the wastebasket, and it was my first dumpster diving for Star Wars, but by far not the last.
That's kind of awesome. Wow. There are, I think, my numbers may be wrong, there are 12 films, 8 live-action shows, 8 miniseries, and 9 animated series all related to Star Wars. Do you have collection pieces from all of these different types of media?
Just about. I think I have something from every one of the media.
Wow.
Because there are comic books and novels and toys and sheets and pillowcases and bandages. Wow. And you name it, they've made it.
That's really impressive. What is your most prized and or your favorite of the objects you have? I know it's a hard question. It's trying to ask, like, who's your favorite kid?
My favorite kid is, my favorite object actually is a canvas banner from 1976, and the banner was hand-painted by a guy named Joe Johnston, and it has the big Star Wars hand-painted logo and uses a piece of art that was on a cast and crew t-shirt that was designed by Ralph McQuarrie, who was responsible for the look of Star Wars.
Wow, yeah, I know who Ralph McQuarrie is. How many pieces do you think you have in your possession, approximately? I know that according to Guinness, you have like more than 90,000, but apparently you have a lot more than that.
That was the inventory at the time in 2013 when they first cited me. Mm-hmm. Well, we figure we have about 400,000 to 500,000 individual items.
Excuse me while I choke. Wow. Past a million items. Did you collect all of these yourself, or have these things been sent into you?
Most of the items are things that I collected myself, but we have fans and other people who send us things for the collection, especially fan-made items, which I treasure. That intersection of pop culture and Star Wars and fans who make things and who are inspired by Star Wars.
On that note, why do you think Star Wars has become such a pop phenomenon? It's been, what, 46 years, I think, since it really, 47 this year will be the year.
I think the timing of the first movie had a lot to do with it. And the underlying mythology, the story, the good versus evil, the visual effects were spectacular for its time. Mm-hmm. And I think the merchandise has played a large role in keeping Star Wars front and center.
That's amazing. I think you're right about that. Do you have a copy of the Revenge of the Jedi poster?
I do indeed. I have about 3,000 posters in the collection.
Wow. I had the Revenge of the Jedi poster a long time ago. I actually sold it because I wanted the money. But it was just cool, the idea that they titled it Revenge of the Jedi and then changed the name to Return of the Jedi. It's one of those, you know, rare posters that I've had in my life.
The original name of the movie was Return of the Jedi. Then Howard Kazanjian, the producer, convinced George that Revenge would be a much better selling title. And George, towards the end, after Fox printed the Revenge poster, decided, no, Jedi don't seek revenge. We'll go back to Return of the Jedi.
Oh, I didn't know the revenge part was a suggestion from somebody else that it was originally returned. That's a great piece of information for a Star Wars geek to know. Thank you very much. I'll use that in my next trivia night. I understand you have the burnt robe of Qui-Gon Jinn. How did you get that? I always mispronounce that character's name.
Well, you'll accept my pronunciation of Qui-Gon Jinn?
Qui-Gon Jinn, absolutely.
Okay. I was on the set of episode one at Leavesden Studios in the UK for a week with the fan magazine editors. We had 8 international fan magazines at the time, and we brought them in to interview the actors and see George actually directing the movie behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And we were on the set when the Qui-Gon Jinn was burned. He had died and they were cremating him. And so it was a little too expensive and a little too scary to burn Liam Neeson. So they used a full-size wax dummy, but they had a Qui-Gon costume on them. And then George calls cut, 2 guys come in with fire extinguishers and they lift the wax dummy and take him back out just in case they needed to redo the scene. And everybody left the set. They called the end of the scene and I followed the guys and they were gone by the time I got there. But there in the grass was the burnt leftovers of the Qui-Gon cape, some of his boot, a food pellet, piece of his belt. And I just saved it for humanity and fandom.
That's an amazing save. I like that. What is the connection? I understand there's a connection between Marin and Star Wars.
Well, of course, Lucasfilm was originally based in Marin County at Skywalker right. Ranch, which still exists and is still owned by George and Skywalker Properties.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Lucasfilm is now headquartered at the Presidio in San Francisco.
Right.
But some of the scenes from the Ewok movies, which were made for television, were filmed in Marin County.
Is there a relationship or an origin of the word Ewok with something in Marin?
We think the Miwok Indians supplied that, maybe even subconsciously supplied that. It's wow. Just like R2-D2 was named after when Walter Murch, who was doing the sound on American Graffiti, called for a reel of sound effects. He called for R2-D2, which was Reel 2, Dialogue 2. And George wrote that down in this little book where he's keeping possibilities for names.
Wow. This has been amazing. the most important question to ask you is, how do you get in to see this amazing collection?
Well, you go online to RanchoObiWan.org. We do tours on Saturdays, and all the information is there, and you get the address when you book the tour.
Well, this Star Wars geek you're talking to has been fascinated by this interview, but unfortunately, I think we've run out of time. So to anyone out there listening, if you want to see this amazing collection, you need only drive to a galaxy not too far, far away. It's actually up in Petaluma. But you have to be sure, as Steve just said, to sign up on the website, RanchoObiWan.org, one word. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been educational, and this is the way.
May the force be with you, Fred.
Take care.
Bye.
That was Fred Pitts with that wonderful interview about Star Wars. And we've had a programming change tonight. So we're going to be running a climate break out of UC Berkeley with my co-host, Ethan Elkind. So stay tuned for that. Ethan always has the best information on climate.
Well, Jeff, welcome to Climate Break. I wanted to start by asking you, hopefully, an easy question, which is if you could just say your name and how you want us to identify you for the program.
My name is Jeff Cadell, and you can just identify me as the author of The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet, which was published by Little Brown in July of 2023.
Great. Well, Jeff, welcome and congratulations on the book. Really enjoyed reading it. So I wanted to start by just asking you, we obviously know that extreme heat is becoming more common with climate change, but I'm wondering kind of how you would describe the problem there in terms of people's understanding. What do you think is sort of one of the challenges that or the misconceptions that might be holding us back from a sort of public perception standpoint about how to about how severe the problem is?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the main problems with understanding heat is the same problem that I had as a journalist covering climate change. I've been thinking about and writing about climate change for 20 years, but and heat is not exactly, you know, a secret. The phrase global warming kind of gives it away. But, you know, so much of the talk about climate change is in, you know, about these targets of 1.5C of warming, 2C of warming. First of all, most people don't know what C means, Celsius means compared to Fahrenheit. These small incremental changes in temperature just seem like not a big deal. So it's very difficult to communicate about the risks and consequences of that. And I didn't really think about it a lot either until about the urgency of it until I happened to be in Phoenix in 2019. Missed my Uber for a meeting and had to take a 20 block walk downtown on a 115 degree day. And by the time I was at the end of those 20 blocks, my heart was pounding and I was dizzy. And I realized heat is dangerous. Heat can kill you quickly. And that was really the birth of the book, was feeling my own risk at this, which was surprising to me because, as I said, I had been covering climate change for a long time and had not really considered the urgency of what these relatively small changes in temperature can mean to us.
And your book talks about a lot of the different types of ways that heat can threaten us. Of course, the basic one is just getting heat stroke and dying. And you have some really tragic stories of that in the book. I'm wondering, you know, what would be a sort of your basic message to the average person who might, you know, not realize extreme heat is an issue, but, you know, what they need to know to protect themselves?
Well, I think there's two things I would say, a basic message of the book. One is I talk about this idea in the book of the Goldilocks zone, that, you know, our bodies and everything, not just our bodies, but the bodies of every living thing have sort of evolved in a relatively stable temperature range. And we're very good at managing our body heat and our, you know, temperatures within that range. But as the climate heats up, we're getting out of that range, getting out of what's called the Goldilocks zone. So the sort of cooling mechanisms that we have and that other living things have are pushing up against the boundaries of what we can handle. And, you know, body temperature is fundamental to life, right? Everyone knows that. The first thing you go to the doctor is they ask you about your temperature. And if you're, it's very simple equation. If you get too hot, you die. There's no It's not only true for humans, it's true for, you know, elephants, it's true for grasshoppers, it's true for everything. So this idea of the Goldilocks zone is really important. The second thing about, you know, what one can do to protect themselves about the risks of extreme heat is that, you know, the risks are about your body temperature rising. And when it gets too hot, what you have to do is get out of the heat. It's really not more complicated than that. There is no medicine you can take. There's no shot you can get. If you go to the emergency room with a heat stroke, they pack you in ice. The risks of extreme heat are very straightforward. It's about your body temperature rising. So the way to protect oneself from extreme heat, whether it's playing football on a hot afternoon or on a hike in the mountains or trapped in an apartment that doesn't have air conditioning, is to get to a cool space and get your body temperature down.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. In a way, you know, you sort of dispelled this notion that just bring a lot of water is going to save you from the heat. And so I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's there's this myth that, you know, you can handle any kind of heat as long as you have plenty of water. And that is that drinking water is somehow like this sort of cooling function, like, you know, as it goes down into your body, it cools things off. And it doesn't work that way at all. There's lots of examples of people who have plenty of water who still get heat stroke and in some cases die. The reason water is important is that our bodies have one cooling mechanism, and that is sweat. And that works pretty well. You know, when your body starts to overheat, your heart starts pumping your blood out towards your skin. The little sweat glands begin to pump water onto the skin. Through the evaporation of that water, it cools the blood under the surface. And that can work pretty well. So drinking water is really important because if you don't have enough liquid in your body, then you can't sweat to the degree that you need to or at all. And then your only cooling mechanism is broken. But there are lots of situations where even though you're sweating, your body temperature is rising faster than that sweat can cool off. And this goes to why, you know, not all heat is equal. More humid heat is more dangerous than dry heat, because in more humid conditions, that evaporation mechanism doesn't work as well. Everyone knows that feeling being in a hot, humid place and you're sitting in a pool of sweat. It's very different than being in the Mojave on a 115 degree day and feeling the sweat kind of evaporating instantly off your body. So water is key in that sense, but it's not a magic cure.
So in addition to what people can do individually, we obviously need some solutions to extreme heat on a society level. And you talk in particular about cities and how we might want to think about, you know, redesigning our cities and thinking about, as we build new communities, how to account for extreme heat. Can you talk about what you think needs to be done at a broader societal level to prepare residents and cities in particular for extreme heat?
Sure. I mean, you know, there's a well-known effect called the urban heat island effect, which is in fact what I felt in Phoenix on that hot day when I got dizzy and kind of realized the risks of extreme heat. You know, cities, as we all know, are built out of concrete and asphalt and glass and steel. All these things absorb and then radiate heat back out. Many cities can be as much as 10 or 15 degrees hotter than the sort of surrounding countryside around them. And that makes them, you know, far more dangerous for people who do not have access to air conditioning or cooling spaces in hot times. So the changes that have to happen is creating sort of more green space in urban areas. There's lots of ways that we can reduce this heat island effect, reduce the heat absorption in cities, cool them off. Simple things like in California, there's a lot of initiatives in places like LA and other places for white roofs. You know, we all know intuitively about this. You know, if you think about Mexico or Greece or other hot places, the Middle East, the buildings were white, and they were white for a reason. It's because that reflects the way the sunlight and is much cooler. We all know that from the difference between wearing a white t-shirt and a black t-shirt on a hot day. But we don't think about that with buildings much. And we need to do much more of that, bringing nature back into cities, planting trees, cooling spaces, but also building places, resilience hubs, places where people can go who don't have air conditioning in their homes to get to a cooling space. I live in Austin, Texas. You know, on hot days here, you know, they have extended hours at libraries. They have free, you can get on the bus for free when the temperature gets above a certain degree. So people who don't have access to cool spaces can just hop on a bus. There's lots of things that can be done, both on the macro scale and the micro scale, to make cities less like ovens as the temperatures rise.
And you talk about air conditioning as potentially providing a false sense of security. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, air conditioning is a topic that I could talk about for 10 hours because it's very fascinating in all kinds of ways, politically, technologically, and everything. But, you know, the basic problem and the basic dilemma with air conditioning is it's often seen as a kind of quick technological fix. Like, what's the problem with a hotter planet? We'll just air conditioning everything. Big deal. That's fine. Well, there's lots of problems with that. First of all, you know, air conditioning requires energy. So as we as the penetration of air conditioning expands, so does power consumption. I just got back from a couple of weeks in India, where 85% of the country, people in the country, do not have air conditioning. There's a big push towards air conditioning there. And 90% of the energy in India still comes from coal. And they're doing a lot of making a lot of progress on renewable energy. But the fact is, they still burn a lot of coal. And so as air conditioning begins to penetrate more deeply in India, so does the fuel consumption, and so does fossil fuel burning, and so does the amount of CO2 they emit. And as the amount of CO2 they emit rises, so does the heat. So you can see this sort of vicious cycle that air conditioning can really perpetuate. And, you know, we have lots of ways of designing buildings and designing spaces with natural cooling, where we don't need to use air conditioners. And so sort of rethinking that is really important. Everything from, you know, efficiency building codes to orientation away from the sun, capturing wind. You know, there's lots of ways that we know how to build structures that don't require bolting on this metal box that sucks the heat out and brings the cool in. And the last thing I'll say about this is that air conditioning, you know, there's a real divide in our world between the people who have air conditioning and the people who don't. And, you know, you and I, and many of the listeners to this podcast, I'm sure, have access to air conditioning. And, you know, we can sweat it out on hot days, and it seems like not a big issue to us. But there are billions, and I mean billions, of people on this planet who do not have access to air conditioning and will never have access to air conditioning for all intents and purposes. And in addition, you know, heat is not just about humans. It's about all, it's about our crops, our food, other living things. We are not going to air condition, you know, the wheat fields. We are not going to air condition the Amazon. You know, air conditioning is not a quick, simple technological fix to the problem of extreme heat.
Well, and the Biden administration, of course, passed the Inflation Reduction Act a couple of years ago, which has a lot of incentives for heat pumps, which is a much more efficient air conditioning technology. It can also provide heating in the wintertime. Does that sort of push for heat pumps as a more efficient source of cooling, does that change the equation at all for you and your thoughts about air conditioning in general?
Yeah, I love heat pumps. We just put one into our house in Austin last summer during the extreme heat wave we had here last summer. Our air conditioning failed, and we had to scramble to put in a new system, and we chose a heat pump, and it's fantastic. You know, heat pumps, you know, use electricity. They're much more efficient. They allowed us to get off of natural gas with our old furnace and air conditioning unit. And heat pumps are a big step in the direction of making all of the cooling systems in our world more efficient. That's certainly a good thing, as are the efficiency standards that the Biden administration is pushing for air conditioning units and things. But it still doesn't resolve the larger paradox of air conditioning that, you know, Some people will have it, some people will not. It is not a quick fix. It is not a simple cure. And there's still this question of where does the energy, the electricity that is used in heat pumps coming from? And, you know, in some places that are moving quickly towards renewables, you know, that's less of a problem. But, you know, a large parts of the world are still, you know, marooned in the fossil fuel world. And as the air conditioning penetration rises, so does the electricity consumption.
Now, I want to go back to this point about what we can do to make cities more resilient to extreme heat. You talked about some of the different architectural methods. What about nature-based solutions, planting more trees? What about cooling centers? Are there other solutions that you'd want to mention that we should be thinking about for making cities more resilient?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned tree planting when I was talking earlier. Tree planting is really important. You know, trees are miraculous in all kinds of ways, for biodiversity, for shade, for evapotranspiration, for, you know, cooling through their absorption of CO2. But trees are and trees are wonderful, and you know, cities like, for example, Paris are doing amazing jobs at really reimagining this sort of ancient and historic city to bring nature back in, to bring the sort of forest back in. And I am a big supporter of that as a solution to cooling off cities. But again, trees are not magic, right? They are, you know, one of the problems with tree planting is that there's a lot of support and interest and energy around planting them, but far less support and interest and energy around maintaining them. And so everyone gets a shovel out and they feel good and they plant street trees and things, and that's all great. And then 5 years later, they're dead. I mean, literally the average length of lifespan of a street tree, an urban tree in, say, Phoenix, Arizona, is 6.2 years. So, you know, it's not, again, a simple fix. We need to think, you know, holistically about that, about how do we maintain them? How do we keep them alive? How, you know, as water stress becomes greater and greater, you know, what kind of trees are we planting? What is their watering requirements for them? You mentioned resilience hubs. Those are really an important idea. And a resilience hub, for people who don't know what that is just, you know, a kind of public place where people can go. You know, whether it's a church, whether it's a standalone structure built with the intent of being a kind of gathering place for people, not only on during extreme heat, but other kinds of extreme weather events. You know, part of the issue is that they're the most vulnerable people to extreme heat and other climate impacts are the people who have the least, you know, access to things like air conditioning or places to go to escape, you know, flooding and things like that. And so resilience hubs are like community centers that are built to, you know, give people a place to go. But, you know, I've visited a lot of them and they're really great and they're really important idea. But again, they have problems, which is that a lot of the people who are most vulnerable to these kinds of things that we're talking about are also they don't trust going to places like that and how to get them there. And, you know, I've spent time with homeless in Texas and in Arizona talking to them about how they cope with extreme heat. And, you know, they're very reluctant to go to these kinds of places for all kinds of pretty obvious reasons. So again, it's a good thing, but it's not a cure-all.
And one of the tragic parts about extreme heat, as you've just referenced, is the inequities of it, how it affects people differently, and particularly people working outdoors. And you have, you know, a really tragic example of an outdoor worker at a nursery in Oregon who died, undocumented immigrant who died working outside in an unprecedented heat wave in the Pacific Northwest. What are some of the solutions that we can take as a society to protect those who are working outside?
Well, this is I'm glad you brought this up, because this is an area that, you know, kind of makes me crazy, simply put. You know, we're talking about air conditioning, technological solutions, you know, rethinking how cities are built. That's all kind of big stuff, technological stuff. You know, changing the risks for outdoor workers is, the solutions are very simple. I mean, we need to have laws to require things like shade breaks, water breaks, which, you know, OSHA has been working on heat rules for, I think, 7 years now and can't manage to pass any kind of, you know, heat rules to ensure worker safety. Some of the states have passed them. Oregon did after the death of the Sebastian Perez, the farm worker that you mentioned. But we still don't have federal standards for heat safety. It's crazy. You know, and, you know, corporations are lobbying against them because they say it'll, you know, decrease productivity and things like that, which is, again, just, you know, practically criminal in the sense that, you know, they're putting productivity over human life. So, and these kinds of things are not expensive to you know, implement. You know, a 20-minute break every couple of hours on a day when the temperatures are over 110 degrees is not an expensive fix, and it can save, you know, lots of lives. So those kinds of things are, you know, all about politics and about political will. They're not about technological innovation or complex city planning or, you know, complex technology or things like that. They're simply about having the will. I mean, here in Texas, where I live, during last summer's heat wave, during the, you know, we had 40 days last summer above 105 degrees. In the middle of that, our governor rolled or vetoed legislation or passed legislation, not vetoed. He passed legislation, signed legislation that forbid any city or county from passing any kind of regulations or laws that would require shade or water breaks for workers. He did that in the midst of the heat wave. And that is the kind of thing that, you know, really raises questions about, you know, kind of what our priorities really are. And do we just think of the workers who are doing this kind of outdoor work, which tend to be, you know, migrants, others who are, you know, kind of off the political radar screen, whether we care about their lives at all?
Yeah, it's just at some level, just a very much a basic human rights issue. That's a pretty shocking story. I wanted to ask you about a comment you made a little bit ago about how this is also affecting our food supply. And you're, in the book, you talk about, you know, how disruptions to food supplies have led to a lot of civil unrest and that a lot of our agricultural production is really vulnerable to extreme heat. What are some of the methods we could think about to safeguard our food supply globally?
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, because, you know, plants are just like any other living thing, like humans. They have their Goldilocks zone too. And, you know, they require a certain range of temperature. And for a lot of places, I spent a lot of time, for example, in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, a highly productive food region. And a lot of the crops there are getting towards the edge of their Goldilocks zone. And Iowa also, the corn crop there is getting, you know, toward the edge of its Goldilocks zone, especially when you combine heat with drought, which are obviously not unrelated. The additional stresses on food crops are enormous. And of course, it's not just the United States. We see that in all parts of the world, most notably in Africa, places like the Sahel, where you've seen massive crop failures. You know, the fix to this is complex. You know, I kind of went into the book thinking, oh, well, you know, I know that many of our key food crops like wheat and corn and others are highly engineered. We know how to engineer crops for different kinds of conditions for higher productivity and things. And I sort of had this naive notion that we just needed to engineer better corn, engineer better wheat. But that's not a simple fix. Heat is not a heat tolerance is not a simple trait like, say, brown eyes in people or something. There's not one gene that kind of controls this. So it's a very complex issue for, you know, agriculture to deal with, for farmers to deal with. You know, there's this sort of false notion that everything's just going to move north towards cooler climates, that, you know, the corn belt in Iowa is just going to move to Minnesota, you know, and that things will just move north. Well, that's not that simple either, because as anyone thinks about it for 2 seconds understands, soil conditions, there's all kinds of other things that, you know, go to creating a kind of productive place to grow crops. So it's a big problem, and it's going to involve lots of shifts in where we grow things. It's going to involve lots of shifts in the kinds of crops that we use as food staples, you know, and also, you know, it's not just agriculture. It's also the, meat industry, you know, here in Texas, you know, cattle ranching is obviously a big thing. They're facing, you know, the same kinds of risks and changes and challenges of extreme heat and drought. So our food system is going to have to, you know, really be recalibrated for this new world that we're living in.
So we've talked about a whole bunch of solutions here about redesigning cities, taking personal precautions, you know, protecting workers, you know, food, potential research. For people listening who want to get involved, try to make their communities or maybe the country as a whole be more resilient to extreme heat, and maybe implement some of the solutions you're describing, what would you recommend? What are some of the things people can do now to get involved and try to help get these policies passed and implemented?
Well, I mean, the first and most obvious is, you know, voting and educating yourself about the candidates and about who is paying attention to this, who is, you know, most aware of these risks, who is has the best policies, who is willing to argue for it, who is willing to fight for it. You know, there's this false notion that, you know, there is a... it's all about just simply the choices that we make, that we just need to get better at, you know, buy, we just need to sell our SUV and get an electric car and recycle more and put in a heat pump and all that. And those are all really important things, and we need to do all those kinds of things. But the real issue here, especially when we're talking about things like heat, but other climate impacts also, they require big picture kind of solutions. They require the big levers. You're not going to redesign how a city is built, reimagine an urban area yourself. That requires politicians who have a vision and have the courage to carry out that vision. We're not going to, you know, the shift to clean energy needs to be accelerated. And the economics of clean energy are much better and are pushing it along. But we need to do that faster. And that needs to happen through, you know, the big levers of government. So, you know, I think by far the most important thing is, you know, getting politically active and educating yourself about candidates. And then the second thing that scientists like Catherine Hayo, who's really great at talking about these kinds of things, is simply the idea of having conversations about it with everyone you know. I mean, making it a topic of conversations. I feel this myself. You know, I was just in LA taking an Uber around, and the Uber driver asked me, you know, what do I do? And I mentioned that I'm a journalist. And then she asked, what kind of journalist? I said, I write about climate change. And I could tell the pause in her voice, you know, about, oh, okay, so we're going to go there, are we? And, you know, you have to talk about it. You have to say, yes, I am. And here's what I think and what I'm doing. And I think that, you know, that sounds like a very small thing, but I think it's a very big thing.
Yeah. So my last question for you is, how bad is this going to get? What is the science telling us about extreme heat? And I mean, are we going to have large swaths of the planet that are going to become uninhabitable?
Well, I mean, I think that is something, you know, the questions raised by what happened in 2023, or the hottest year, you know, that humans have ever recorded in human history, has raised a lot of questions about whether the warming is accelerating or not, how accurate the climate models, the projections really are. There's some debate among scientists about this right now, but it was certainly not an encouraging sign. Things like the extreme warming of the ocean right now that we're seeing is very disturbing. That's going to change weather patterns. So, you know, I think that we are have a wild ride in front of us. And until we really get serious about reducing emissions, because after all, that is what's driving warming. And it's really important. I think a widely misunderstood idea is that the warming will continue until we get to zero emissions, right? And we're not going back to the old climate of yesterday. We're moving into a new climate era. And so thinking broadly about that and about how to adapt to that, what kind of changes do we need to make to cities? How do we need to think differently about how we live on the coasts? how we need to think differently about.
You've been listening to Climate Change with Ethan Alkine here on KALW. You can listen to the rest of that episode on our website at klw.org.